Abbey 104.
Good morning, it's Abbey 104. It's Sunday morning at 11.05. It's time for Folk Tales. I'm Terry Bennett, and in the studio this morning, my guest is Christopher Coville. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Terry. Nice to be here.
Oh, thank you for coming in. Delighted. And Chris, you have a long, distinguished career in the Royal Air Force, and you've been a chairman of Westlands in the past, amongst many other things. Mm. Just tell us a little bit about the RAF.
Well, I was brought up, as you know, Terry, in Liverpool, yes. And I was pretty idle at school, and I decided that an academic career would be entirely inappropriate. And I'd looked around and said, well, I definitely don't want to work. What can I do? Thought about the acting profession, but my little dalliance into that didn't work terribly well as an amateur, as a boy. And then I discovered flying through the Air Cadets. I joined the Air Training Corps. I was immediately bitten by the bug and thought, my goodness, if I can get paid to do this, this would be wonderful. So I applied for a Royal Air Force scholarship, which I managed to achieve. And that kept me going through the sixth form. And I joined the Royal Air Force and went to Cranwell in 1964.
And you had, as I say, an illustrious career in the RAF. You rose to the rank of Air Marshal, and you retired in 2003, was it?
Yes, I left the Royal Air Force in 2003.
Yes.
I then joined the Volunteer Reserve. So having been an Air Marshal, I was relegated to the rank of flying officer in the Volunteer Reserve. And the task of the Volunteer Reserve is, in essence, to fly air cadets. And I flew at Culzean near Bath for another 10 years or so until, sadly, they discovered my age and decided I was too old to continue flying. But flying has always been a passion for me, and I continue flying through the medium of gliding at the Devon and Somerset Gliding Club at North Hill near Honiton. So it's been a wonderful part of my life, and I'll keep it going as long as I can.
We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And you, as I alluded to, were a chairman of Westlands, having become a helicopter pilot during your RAF career. And so Westlands was a very logical company to go and head up, I suppose.
Well, it was, and of course it was fairly local too. Yes, I was quite late learning to fly helicopters. I'd been a fast jet pilot, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But when I was Air Commodore Flying Training and responsible for all of the flying training for the Royal Air Force, I decided, being we always refer to as someone who is passionate about flying, and I decided that I had to fly everything in the Royal Air Force that was involved in flying training. And I'd never flown helicopters before. I'd flown in, but never flown them. And I went to do a course and discovered it was an absolute joy. And I think I took to it quite well. And then later, of course, it was very logical then to move into Westland. And I had a call from Westland asking if I'd go and have a discussion with them. I became a non-executive director initially for 2 to 3 years, and then did 6 wonderful years as chairman between 2005 and 2011.
Mm. Right. Another thing we will come back to later. Let's have your first record. This is The Beatles and Hey Jude.
Yes, because I was brought up in Liverpool. And I tell people that I was born before BC, before the Beatles came. But being a teenager in Liverpool in the 1960s was absolutely wonderful. And I hope we can talk a little bit more about my hometown. I'm very fond of it. And the Beatles, of course, were a marvellous part of my youth, and I hold a great love for the Beatles' music even today.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart, then you can start to make it better. Don't be a afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better. And anytime you feel the pain,
that's the Beatles and Hey Jude, as chosen by my guest in the studio this morning, Air Marshal Sir Christopher Coville. And Chris, you were born in Liverpool just after the war, and grew up in that area. What was Liverpool like in the late 40s then?
Well, initially, my early recollection of Liverpool was lots of bomb sites, as you can imagine. Liverpool is a very important port, and having large Air Force, United States Air Force bases nearby, the nearest one being a massive base of 25,000 people at Burton Wood, just outside Liverpool, was quite a target for the Nazi bombers, and Liverpool was quite badly affected by the bombing raids. I remember actually a degree of poverty around in the city, a lot of soldiers, sailors and airmen coming back and struggling to find work, occupations. But nevertheless, it was a lovely place. Liverpool's always been a friendly place to grow up in. If you talk to any students who go to university, they always say they loved being in Liverpool. Liverpoolians have a great sense of humour, and I think even through the difficult times after the war, that humour still survived and, if anything, probably flourished. I do remember, actually, things starting to get better in the 1950s. That's when the Merseybeat started, and Liverpool started to export its music globally. I like to think I had something to do with that, because in 1963, I went on the International Air Cadet Exchange to the United States. I don't think I'd been outside the country, certainly outside the British Isles at that stage. I went on this wonderful trip to the United States, and this was just before the Beatles hit the United States, and I had my guitar with me. And we ended up, the British cadets went to Idaho, which is out in the West, and they'd never heard of Mersey music, and I was able to introduce them to a lot of the music that I'd learned in my time in Liverpool. So I don't think I ever got any credit for that, and certainly never got any royalties for it. But Liverpool was a great place to grow up in. I went to a school along with many other kids, aged up to 11. I was brought up as a Catholic. I went to a primary school. I do remember, actually, the regime was rather harsh. All the teachers walked around with a stick in those days and used it quite liberally. And then I went to a grammar school in Liverpool at the age of 11, after passing the dreaded 11 plus. And I was taught by the De La Salle brothers, who were a lay teaching order. So they weren't priests, but they wore the gowns and all the paraphernalia of being lay brothers. And by and large, they were really wonderful people, dedicated to education. And I was very lucky. I had a very good education as a grammar school boy. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, I was not really inclined to academe. I didn't enjoy being at school. I'd far rather be out. I was a scout to start with. I loved getting out into the countryside, and then as I mentioned, I discovered flying. But quite interestingly, when I was in the sixth form, my priorities were flying and girls and a certain amount of evening drinking as well, perhaps. No smoking, interestingly. I never attracted to smoking. But when I was in the sixth form, all I had to do to get to Cranwell, because I had the scholarship, which I got from the age of 16, was to get some pretty average A-level results. Well, you can guess that with my inclination to outside pleasures, I didn't do terribly well in my first lot of A-levels. And I was told by the Air Force that I wouldn't go to Cranwell. I'd do a short service commission because I didn't have the qualifications to go to the RAF College, which was pretty well a university-type course, 3 years. And I decided that that's what I would do. I'd go and do a short service commission. But just as I was about to post the letter, which actually accepted a short service commission, I thought, no, I don't want to do this. I want to go back to school, be a better boy, and improve my A-levels. So I pulled the letter out, and I tore it up, went to speak to the RAF, and they were very sympathetic and said, yes, but you've got to promise to do better next year. And I promised I didn't do very much better, as it happens, but I did well enough.
Well enough.
But the real irony was it was in that year that I met Irene, who's now my wife. So if I'd have been more diligent, or if I'd posted that letter, I never would have met Irene, and we're celebrating our 52nd wedding anniversary.
We should say that Irene is sat patiently listening in the corner.
Yeah, keeping an eye on me and listening to Irene, about to hit me in the back of the head. So it's how ironic that was. But yes, eventually then I did go to Cranwell, the RAF College, and I know we're going to be talking a little more about
that
later.
That. Just tell me about family life. Was it just you or brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had two brothers. I was in the middle, which is apparently always the worst place to be. My big brother, who is an American now, lives in the United States. He's lived there for a long time. He became an industrial chemist and did very well. My younger brother, who sadly died some years ago of cancer, 2 years younger than myself. We had a happy family life up until, I suppose, the time I was 15, 16, when my elder brother had cancer, bowel cancer, and suffered very badly from that. And it very much affected my poor mother, who died when she was only 47. My father was an accountant and originally ran a piano factory until people stopped buying pianos, and then he moved into radio and television. But from the age of 16 onwards, and that was for the 3 years that I was in the sixth form, we were without a mother, and we all had to learn to look after ourselves. And my job, actually, was the one to do the cooking in the evening and prepare the evening meal for everybody. And I think that was perhaps one of the reasons that Irene was attracted to me, that I could actually help her out with the cooking, although she's become a very good chef in her own right these days.
You came with culinary skills, didn't you?
Right, indeed.
I think that's probably a good moment to take your second record. This is the Foray Requiem.
Yes, my dear father was... he was a tenor in the Liverpool Philharmonic Choir. And he was also... He was the person who, in the local church... was the lead of the choristers, and he was always very devoted to singing. He, in fact, stayed in the Philharmonic Choir until he was 75, because they always had trouble finding tenors, and Dad had a wonderful voice, though it started to fail him when he got into his 70s. But both he and my mother loved this piece of music, Foray's Requiem Sanctus.
Thank you.
The Sanctus from Fauré's Requiem, and that was Tenebrae, the choir Tenebrae, and the London Symphony Orchestra Chamber Ensemble, chosen by my guest today, Sir Christopher Coville. Chris, we got to the point where you had done your A-levels and been accepted into the RAF, into their training college, and you duly went off and joined them. So what was that like?
It was a bit of a shock, to be honest, Terry. I'd had an enormous amount of freedom living as a grammar school boy and living at home, able to do what teenagers want to do. And I arrived at the Royal Air Force College, Cranwell, in Lincolnshire in October 1964. This was very much an extension of public schools. It was a three-year course based on university lines. And most of the boys, and there were no girls there in those days, it was boys only, most of the boys had been to public school, and 90% actually had been to public school, and only 10% of us were the brats from grammar school. And I have to say that I found that transition quite challenging. For the first term, which was 6 months, we were not allowed out of Cranwell at all. The regime was quite harsh. We'd be up at 6 o'clock in the morning doing drill, then go do some academics and finish the day with physical training, cross-country running. We were all fit as fleas. But, of course, we were young men and we wanted to go out. And Irene was at university at Manchester at the time. And we weren't even allowed out at weekends, so I couldn't go across to see her. Although I did actually sneak across, unbeknown to the college, to see Irene on one occasion. But at the end of the first year, we had a special inspection called the Assistant Commandant's Inspection. And if we got through that, we were allowed in our second term to go to Sleaford on Wednesday and Saturday evenings to be back by 23:59. As you probably know, midnight doesn't exist in the armed forces. It's always 23:59. So if you arrive at midnight, you're 1 minute late. And I don't know whether you know Sleaford, Terry, but I would perhaps say it makes Sturminster Newton look like Las Vegas. But it was a wonderful 3 years, and we made very good friends. I mean, you know, in adversity, friendships, very strong friendships are made, which survive to this day. I did indicate that I didn't do terribly well initially. I was considered to be bolshy and stroppy, and it was absolutely true. I didn't respond well to the Cranwell regime, to the extent that after 6 months I was put on review for lack of officer qualities, and the squadron commander quite rightly gave me a dressing down and then told me to go and talk to the senior under officer, who was the head boy, if you like, who would give me further advice. And the senior under officer had been head boy at Eton.
Okay.
And in the interests of anonymity, I'll call him Carruthers. And Carruthers looked me up and down and said, in the clipped Etonian accent, "Coville, I understand you're on review for lack of officer qualities." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, I'm not at all surprised. Now, let me give you some further advice." The squadron commander probably felt he couldn't. "Unless you get rid of that awful Liverpool accent, you will never get on in the Royal Air Force." Well, Terry, many years later, I was an Air Vice Marshal, a two-star. And he was a one-star, an Air Commodore working for me, running the Central Flying School. And Irene and I pitched up for the annual formal inspection of the Central Flying School to see Carruthers resplendent in his number one uniform with the girls waiting to open the doors of the cars. And as the doors opened, he said, "Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to the Central Flying School." I said, "All right there, Carruthers, you're right there." And he said, "Oh, don't be beastly, sir." A lesson for any of the young people listening: remember that when you're on that slippery pole going up, you might come sliding down and meet the people that you've been beastly to.
Yes, good advice, certainly, and I think it applies in a number of professions.
I think so.
After that, were you a reformed character then? You obviously did quite well, so you must have taken his advice in some shape.
Others might be a better judge than myself. Maybe Irene would be a better judge. But I started to pull my socks up, and the main reason for that was that we started flying at the end of the first term, and we started flying in a lovely little aeroplane called the Jet Provost. This was, you know, 300 mile an hour, 350 mile an hour aeroplane, And I thought, my goodness, this is why I joined the Royal Air Force, not for the drill and all the other things that went with it. Although I've come to love that too, over the ceremonial, over the years. But it was really flying, and I knew that I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I wasn't interested in any other form of flying. And so I had to work very hard. In those days, only the top 20% from Cranwell were going to go on to fast jet training. And of those 20%, only 20% would go on to single-seat fighters. And then, in those days, the Lightning was coming into service. Wonderful, wonderful aeroplane. And I thought, my goodness, if I can ever fly that aeroplane, I will be a very happy man. So I set my targets as a fairly young flight cadet at Cranwell on becoming a Lightning pilot.
And you went on to do that, of course.
I did indeed.
And you
yes.
flew Phantoms as well at a later stage.
And the Tornado air yes. defence variant as well, yes.
Right. So what happened after your training then at the RAF College? What immediately followed that?
Well, I went to Royal Air Force Valley in Anglesey. Mm. And it was there that we flew a lovely aeroplane called the Gnat. This was the first aeroplane used by the Red Arrows. And it was a big jump up from the Jet Provost. And actually, we started to see the first fatalities. You know, it's actually, people forget that even in peacetime, we do lose quite a few pilots in training. And the Gnat was, but it was a delightful aeroplane. It was supersonic in a gentle descent, very, very agile, but very challenging. I had to, again, get in that top 20% to make it to the Lightning. Fortunately, I did. I was actually in the top 10%, and I was streamed out to fly the Lightning. But before doing that, we had to do 100 hours on the venerable Hunter. The Gnat didn't have any weapons, so we had to... Remember, we're actually not flying for fun. We're flying as a weapon of war in the end. And so we moved on to the tactical weapons unit at RAF Chivna in Devon, and it was there that we flew the Hunter for 100 hours before the very first trip I got, which was in 1968 on the aeroplane I'd really set my sights on, the Lightning.
In the middle of all this, you had some musical experience. Did you not get involved in a group somewhere?
Yes. I've got rather odd initials, C-C-C-C. I'm not sure whether my father had a stammer when he was I was being baptized or whether he's just unimaginative, but Christopher Charles Cotton Coville, we decided to call our little group at Cranwell, this was originally, the Cotton Trio. We had a chap playing a banjo and someone with a tambourine with an excellent voice, and we played around all the local pubs and clubs and so on. I'd actually been in a group in Liverpool. We were called the Black Hawks. I always remember we had two engagements and we got £5 for each of those two engagements. But one of the people in the group was a chap called Mike Kelleher, who was from an Irish family. And he was an absolutely marvellous lead guitarist. And one day he said to me, Chris, you know Django Reinhardt, don't you? And I hadn't heard of Django Reinhardt. And he said, well, he's probably the best guitarist in the world, and you really should listen to him. And I listened to Django Reinhardt, and I've been an avid fan of Django's ever since. Sadly, of course, he died many years ago, but I did manage to see his buddy, Stefan Grappelli, who played the violin, jazz violin. I saw him live in Brussels. But Django's got a very special place in my heart. Thank you.
Django Reinhardt and New Ages from 1947, one of his best-known compositions. And that's chosen by Christopher Covell, who's my guest in the studio. Chris, we got as far as the fact that you were flying for the first time, having graduated, as it were, from RAF in Cranwell. And projecting forward a little bit, well, you obviously enjoyed flying fast jets. That must have been very rewarding, was it?
Yes, it was. It was a wonderful. And I thought, my goodness, I'm a very lucky man to be doing this. The Lightning was a fabulous aeroplane. It was way ahead of anything else in that we're talking about the late 60s, 70s. I was posted to RAF Binbrook. There's a story there, actually, because when I proposed to Irene, she was a little bit doubtful about whether this would be a good idea. And I promised she'd see the world, and there we were in the Lincolnshire Wolds, having dragged her through RAF Valley and RAF Chivenor. But the Lightning itself, it was a wonderful aeroplane. I'll give you just a few facts. 0 to 100 miles an hour in 3 seconds. It could be at 30,000 feet in less than 2 minutes. It would fly at twice the speed of sound. You could climb at 1.3 the speed of sound. And it was just astonishing. And we used to love bouncing the American F-100s that were flying around in the UK in those days, doing practice interceptions and really showing them a clean pair of heels. It was very challenging to fly. You're single-man operations, doing high-speed operations, including low-level at night, electronic countermeasures and so on. And it sometimes surprises people that we lost about 10% of our pilots during that period, and certainly we lost quite a few friends. But the Lightning had some shortfalls. It was a bit short on fuel. It only had 2 missiles. And we did replace it with the Phantom, the American F-4 Phantom. But we did anglicise it by putting Rolls-Royce engines in it, so sort of raised its class level somewhat. And I converted to the Phantom and absolutely loved it. There were many advantages of the Phantom. It had twice as much fuel. It had 4 times as many weapons. The big challenge was I had to learn to fly with a navigator for the first time, having flown single seat up until then. But I found that actually it was a very welcome step forward, because it had been a bit of a handful flying the Lightning, especially a dark, dirty night up over the North Sea. It's a very lonely position to be in, particularly as our main job in peacetime was intercepting Soviet aircraft that were coming down into UK airspace. And to have someone else there to help you to do that job, I found very, very rewarding, very satisfying, and enabled me to do my fighter pilot job better.
Your first command came in 1983. Did that signal a reduction in the number of hours that you were in the sky?
Far from it. As a squadron commander, I felt it was very important to lead from the front. Of course, as I indicated, I was a bit of a hog anyway, always insisted on flying at least as much as anyone else and very often more. But no, and it's interesting, it's something that came up in discussion last evening when I spoke about the Red Arrows, that I felt that when I commanded Treble One Squadron at Lucas, Phantom Squadron, I was 34 when I arrived, and I felt that I was absolutely at my peak. I had experience, I had judgment, and my reactions had not really slowed down. And I was very physically fit during those days. And I absolutely loved my time in command of Treble One Squadron. Sadly, over too quickly, just a 2.5-year tour. But that was, to me, probably the highlight of my service career, commanding a fighter squadron in my mid-30s.
You moved on to Coningsby not too long after that, again in command, but that was 1986, wasn't it?
Yes, I did a year on the staff at Headquarters 11 Group at Bentley Priory as Crew Captain Operations. That was on promotion to Wing Commander. And halfway through that tour, I was very surprised when my Air Officer Commanding called me in and said, I know you're expecting to be here for another year, but for very complex reasons, you're going to have to take over RAF Coningsby. Which wasn't absolutely ideal from Irene's point of view, because yet again, there was no overseas posting that I'd promised. But it was taking the new aircraft, the Tornado air defence variant, the Tornado F3, into service. So when I arrived on the base, we had Phantoms, which I'd flown, Tornadoes, which I'd been checked out on but hadn't become operational on. But the real prize was it was also the home of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight with its wonderful Hurricane Spitfires and, at that time, the only flying Lank in the world, Lancaster.
What's it like getting out of something as advanced as a Tornado and then getting into a Spitfire? The flying skills are essentially the same, I suppose, but it must be like getting out of a brand new car and getting into a Model T or something, isn't it?
Well, it is to an extent. And actually, on one day, when we still had Phantoms, in one day I flew all of the fighters on my station. So I flew the Phantom at 7 o'clock in the morning. At 10 o'clock, I flew the Tornado. At 1 o'clock, I flew the Hurricane, and at 3 o'clock, I flew the Spitfire. I'm not sure who was running the station at the time, but I was having a great day. I found the Hurricane and the Spitfire both a delight to fly, challenging, and particularly in a crosswind. Of course, during the war, most of the airfields had at least three runways, all were grass, so you always took off and always landed into wind. And we don't have that luxury anymore. We tend to have one very long runway. We certainly did at Coningsby, with hardly any crosswind options. So very often we'd come back and be landing in a crosswind. And that was quite challenging. The other thing about flying, and I was a display pilot with the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, the other thing is that you have very limited avionics, whereas in the Tornado we knew exactly where we were to a metre all the time. And it was a two-man crew. When I was in a Hurricane or a Spitfire going to do a display, I was on my own with a stopwatch, a compass and a map. And that was it. It was back to real flying.
Let's take your next track. This is the Schindler's List. Why this?
Yes, one of the great influences in my life has been my Uncle Stephen. Stephen was Czechoslovakian when it was Czechoslovakia. He was born in Bratislava. Jewish family. He was an only child, and during the war his mother was sent to Auschwitz. He never saw her again, and his father was beaten to death in front of him when he was only 14. He married my mother's sister, hence he is my uncle, and he is a most wonderful man with no bitterness. He's a very wise man. He's now 92. His brain is still absolutely wonderful. He's obviously getting a little frail in terms of his body. But he's always been a great example to me of not being resentful, not being bitter, and actually always being positive about life. And it's his Jewish background and what he went through that actually brought me to think that the theme from Schindler's List was entirely appropriate.
The theme from Schindler's List, with music by John Williams from 1993, chosen by my guest today, Sir Christopher Covell. Chris, we've got to the point where you were flying all sorts of very exciting aircraft, but in 1992 you were promoted to Air Vice Marshal, and that the title was Air Officer Commanding Training Group. So what was that?
Yes, I had responsibility for all training in the Royal Air Force. That's every type of training. Flying, ground training. And that was a marvellous job. You know, I absolutely loved it. I was well supported, had an excellent staff. And it gave me an opportunity to continue flying, which was very important to me. And it was at that stage that I actually started to learn to fly helicopters, did a little bit of helicopter flying during that period, and very much enjoyed it. I also learned to fly the Jetstream twin prop aeroplane, which, again, I'd never done before. But one of the great joys of the job, and rather going back to my time as OC Coningsby, BBMF, Battle of Britain Memorial Flight being there, when I took over the training group, I had the Red Arrows in my command. And one of my jobs was to fly regularly in the back seat with the Red Arrows and to do the initial lead-in for them, to help them get through the difficult, challenging workup period. Because every year they get three new pilots and they all change formation. They change out of their red into the green flying suits, and they don't take the red flying suits again until they've been cleared by the commander-in-chief for public display authority. So I had lots and lots of flying with the Red Arrows and got to know them all very well. It was a wonderful, wonderful tour. Sadly, just 2 years before, never having served in the Ministry of Defence, having evaded going to the Ministry of Defence, at the end, they collared me and said, we want you to go and do a job in the MOD running operational requirements. So my wonderful 2 years of flying and flying with the Red Arrows came to an end, and for the first time I went into the political scene in Whitehall.
Was this Assistant Chief of Defence? Is that the...
I was the Assistant Chief of Defence Staff for Operational Requirements, right. Yes. And actually, I have to say, it was a very important and very rewarding job. We were going through the biggest re-equipment programme the Royal Air Force has had since 1945. And the then Chief of the Air Staff called me in and said, Chris, no pressure. You've got the most important job in the RAF at the moment, and you have to deliver the biggest re-equipment programme we've had since the Second World War. So go ahead and do it.
Well, you obviously saw that through, and in 1998 you became Air Marshal and Deputy Commander-in-Chief Allied Forces Central Europe. So that was a NATO position, was it?
Yes, it was. I had done a NATO appointment as a wing commander, as the personal staff officer to the military representative to NATO, who was a four-star Royal Navy Admiral, actually, and a bachelor workaholic. That was quite an interesting tour, but that would take a whole hour talking about that tour. Yes, I went as what was called DSIN-SENT, we're great on our abbreviations in the military. And it was the time of the Balkans conflicts, and I was given the task of preparing people to go to run the headquarters staffs and also to give some top-down guidance on the use of air power during the Balkans war. I did visit the Balkans, and I must say it was a tragic place to visit. Some wonderful people there, but the level of hatred I'd never seen, never witnessed before, and some of the atrocities on both sides, I have to say, really were astonishing. But it was a very, very rewarding job, and I've always enjoyed working with the NATO countries. I've actually always felt quite European and cosmopolitan rather than being entirely British. But I'm not going to mention the B word.
I think we don't have time for that. You then moved on to become Commander-in-Chief Personnel and Training.
Yes, it was dual-hatted with an Air Force Board position called the Air Member for Personnel. In Navy terms, that's the second Sea Lord, and I used to call myself the second Air Lord because I thought it sounded so much better than Air Member for Personnel. So basically, I was running all of the non-operational side of the Royal Air Force, including, again, the Red Arrows, who were, and I had to give public display authority to the Red Arrows on behalf of the Air Force Board. But I had, as well as all of the training, all the personnel management, HR, if you like, these days in modern parlance, I had the doctors, the dentists, the lawyers, so everyone who was non-operational. That was a third of the Air Force. I had something like 15,000 people under command during that period, and that was my my last full-time job in the Air Force, and I absolutely loved it.
And you were officially retired in 2003. Mm-hmm. Was that a big wrench to leave after all that time?
It was awful. I remember going through the main gate of my headquarters, and there was a long guard of honour, and people came out to wave me goodbye. I had quite a lump in my throat. I remember handing in my identity card at the gate as I left, and realising that if I'd left a jacket or something in my office, I couldn't go back in to the headquarters that I'd commanded up until a minute before. It really was quite a wrench, but it was considerably helped by then joining the Volunteer Reserve, which I was in for another 12 years. I was demoted from Air Marshal to Flying Officer, and that's what the price you pay for joining the Volunteer Reserve. And the job of the VRT, as it was called, was to fly Air Training Corps cadets. So having been a cadet myself, I was putting something back in and flying these wonderful young people in an aeroplane called the Tutor, a little piston aeroplane at RAF Killearn.
We are running a little bit short on time, so let's take your next track. This is Sister Sledge and We Are Family.
I think family is so important, and we lose sight of that at our peril. I think families are right at the core of society. Families are in good shape, society's in good shape. So I'm going to dedicate this to Peter, Andrea, and their little boy Leo, to Nikki, Devin, their children Tara, Meta, and Soren, to Teresa and her children Jack, Lucy, and Sadie, and also to Johnny, who's a very good friend of Teresa's and the family. And Johnny is actually cooking the meal for us today, and in about an hour's time, I shall be eating his beef.
We are family. I've got all my sisters with me. We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing. We are family. I've got all my sisters with me. We are.
Sister Sledge there, and We Are Family. Chris, let's get to your Westlands involvement. How did that come about?
Well, I was living locally, and there was a chap called Kevin Smith, who was then the CEO of GKN, who had a part share with Finn Mechanica in Westland Helicopters, or Agusta Westland, which is the joint company between the Italian Agusta and Westlands here. And I was invited by Richard Case, who was then the chairman and the chief executive of Westland Helicopters, to come up and have a chat, in his words. And actually what he wanted to do was invite me to become a non-executive director. And so that's how I began. It was obviously leaning back on my service experience, particularly my time in the Ministry of Defence, when I got to know a lot of people in defence and aerospace business. But, you know, it was a wonderful company, still is a wonderful company. The oldest, when I was the chairman, the oldest of the surviving aerospace companies in the world. And people often forget that Westland built fixed-wing aeroplanes. They actually built some Spitfires, and they built the aeroplane, the Whopper T, that was out there in the northern frontier, flying in places like Afghanistan in the in the 20s, and actually the a development of the Wapiti with upgraded engines and with oxygen was the first aeroplane to fly over the top of Everest. So a absolutely wonderful, rich history that that company has before it specialised in helicopters after the Second World War.
And you were in overall charge of that? No, you weren't.
No, not really, Terry. Well, I mean, I was a non-executive chairman, so I ran the board but didn't run the company. Yeah, I had influence in the company, obviously. It's a progression after the scandals of Enron and others that it was decided that each company should have a non-executive chairman and a chief executive to make sure that the chief executive and the chief finance officer weren't fiddling the books, as happened in a few cases. But nevertheless, I absolutely loved it, and I was very, very proud indeed to be the chairman of such a wonderful company.
So if you look at the RAF today, you're still actively involved. You said at the beginning you're gliding now, which is a rather more sedate form of flying than maybe you were used to. But look back at the RAF as you knew it, compared with what it is today. Is it that much different?
Well, it is, but I just want to have a quick going back on Westland. I think it's rather sad that the government has chosen to buy off the shelf many helicopters that actually could have been bought from Westland, and I think it's having a dramatic effect on Westland helicopters. And in particular, after the Wildcat, which is a wonderful helicopter, which is entering service now for the Navy and the Army. After that, there really isn't very much for Westland, and I think it's awfully sad that the government has taken that decision. But the Air Force today, well, when I joined the RAF in 1964, we had 175,000 people in uniform. It's come down to 31,500. And that's reflected in the other two services. The Navy is now 25,000, the Army 87,000. Of course, our role, global role, has diminished, and in the end, it's the decision of government, and we vote the governments in, as to the size and the shape and the effectiveness of our armed forces. What I will say is the equipment that the RAF has got is absolutely superb, and the people the RAF has today are splendid. I guess we can say, Terry, that the RAF has never been the biggest air force in the world. But it always has been, is today, and I think always will be, the very best.
And how do you keep yourself amused in your spare time? I don't imagine you have a lot. You're involved still with the cadets.
Yes, I'm the Honorary President of Air Cadet Gliding. Mm-hmm. I'm also President of the Honiton Air Training Corps Squadron. Right. I glide, as I told you. I run several charities. And I am also involved with a cyber company called Secure Cloud Plus as their senior defence advisor. And I've been working very closely with the Aviation Skills Partnership. And it's a wonderful organisation that's the vision and brainchild of a wonderful chap called Simon Witz, who recognised that we needed to revitalise the aviation skills in this country. And that's everything you see as an airport pilot, air traffic control, on-aircraft engineer, cabin crew, security. The UK has a rich heritage in that area, and we are determined to get it back where it belongs, at the forefront of aviation and aerospace.
And you're now a lecturer on cruise ships. That must be tough work.
It's very tough. It's very tough on my waistline. But I absolutely love it. So we go on, I guess, three. Last year we did four cruises. And I very much enjoy it. I mean, when you arrive, you're treated as a passenger, but once you do the first lecture, you've broken cover. And I love the engagement with fellow passengers, and some of the amazing stories that they come and tell me about. And also, we've had some great friends we've made, who fellow lecturers, including an astronaut, you know, one chap who was one of the team that fixed the Hubble telescope, and many other people like that. Really, very rich experiences.
As a final aside, you're a lifelong supporter of Everton Football Club.
Yes, I do have that haunted look to me, do I not? Although they did win, they beat West Ham yesterday. I am told that I'm the only Everton supporter to have risen above the rank of corporal, but I'm not sure whether that's really true or not.
Chris, thank you very much for coming in. It's been fascinating talking to you.
It's been a real pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Sir Christopher Coble, thank you.